change of leadership at Google raises a question.
Does the company's CEO still matter?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. It's the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, January 21st. Coming up, a loss at Bank of America, a profit at Wells Fargo. What to make of all these bank earnings? The smell of success goes on sale, and cabbies in New York get a dress code. What, they have to dress up to ride people around? That's later.
But first, Google surprised Wall Street and Silicon Valley yesterday with the news that 37-year-old co-founder Larry Page will take over as the company's new CEO. 55-year-old Eric Schmidt has been Google's chief for the last 10 years. Meanwhile, tech giant Hewlett-Packard has announced a leadership shakeup of its own. For more on all of this, let's bring in our Silicon Valley correspondent, Steve Henn. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
So why is this shakeup happening at Google, Steve?
Well, Eric Schmidt, Google's outgoing CEO, joked on Twitter that adult supervision at Google was no longer necessary. So this is how he actually put it on the conference call.
I believe Larry is ready. He's been working on this area for a long time. His ideas are very interesting and clever, and it's time for him to have a shot at running this and doing it, and I'm sure he'll do a fantastic job.
So when Eric Schmidt was brought in as CEO of Google a decade ago, he really was thought of as the adult supervision for Larry Page and Sergey Brin, right, the founders. 10 years on, I think the concern here in Silicon Valley isn't really about supervision as much as sort of youthful vigor. It hasn't really done anything to challenge Facebook. Its attempt to break into the TV market with Google TV pretty much imploded. And, you know, it promised a music service a year ago that never materialized. So there's some concern about what's going on there.
Now, Steve, there was another shuffle over at Hewlett-Packard. Tell us what's going on there.
And there was a high-profile turnover at Apple with
right,
Steve Jobs. You know, it's been quite a week. The turnover at HP is probably the most dramatic in many ways. You know, in the past 5 months, they've replaced their CEO by firing Mark Hurd. They've replaced the company's chairman, and now they've replaced four board members. I think there's a feeling at HP that they just need a fresh start. The board was widely seen as dysfunctional. They're facing shareholder lawsuits, and they're just trying to start over. Reboot.
Marketplace's Steve Henn fully booted up for us this morning. Thank you so much for your time.
Sure thing.
Let's get some more analysis of the Google move with Jill Schlesinger, editor-at-large at CBS MoneyWatch. She's with us from New York, as she is every Friday. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
What does this news do to Google? I mean, are we going to see any changes to Google products and its websites?
Well, I think Page's return is really meant to rejuvenate the search giant. I suspect that social networking will soon become a big focus for Google. And so for all of us Google users, look out, because they're trying to find the users from Facebook and Twitter and grab them and have them stay longer on Google.
Looking at the larger scope of things, right? Does the CEO of any company really matter, Jill?
Absolutely. The CEO matters. Let's look at Apple. The announcement of Steve Jobs' medical leave was met with trepidation. That's because Jobs infused that company with his creative imprint, and because he hadn't groomed his successor like Eric Schmidt had done with Larry Page. And so now Apple's next chapter remains murky. That said, I'm always nervous when a CEO sort of becomes bigger than the company. In my mind, while the world was really praising Jack Welch at GE in the 90s, he was leading the company down a path of destruction. His more staid successor, Jeff Immelt, actually guided the company through the recession and effectively turned it around.
All right. Jill Schlesinger with us from New York. Jill, thanks.
Great to be with you.
Now let's talk bank earnings. Bank of America said this morning mortgage problems led it to a $1.2 billion loss last quarter, bringing an end to a week of bank earnings that have been all over the place. Chris Lowe is chief economist at FTN Financial, and he's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So looking at these earnings, I don't really know what to make of them. We've got Bank of America with a loss. Goldman Sachs had a profit, but a smaller one than before. Wells Fargo, a record profit. What's the message?
Well, look, it boils down to two things, I guess. One of them is that banks are scrambling to conform with Dodd-Frank. That's the financial reform that was done
right
by Congress last year. Those banks that were not really banks before, like Goldman, essentially a trading shop, are really struggling under this one because proprietary trading is no longer allowed.
Trading that banks do themselves with their own money.
That's exactly right. Now, a bank like Wells Fargo, which is essentially, they do have a trading operation, but it's on behalf of customers. Morgan Stanley also, they did very well because customer trading is fine. As for Bank of America, well, Bank of America, this was luckily for them a one-time expense. It reflects their purchase of Countrywide, and that was just flat-out mortgage fraud.
All right, Chris, give me the 10-second answer here. Why do we care if we're not invested in the banks?
Well, unfortunately, the reason we really care is that Dodd-Frank is going to take away a lot of the ways that banks were making money in the past, which means they're going to be finding all kinds of ways to stick us with new fees over the next couple of years.
Oh, great. Something to look forward to in 2011. Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial, thanks so much.
Securities regulators in Washington have come up with some new rules designed to avoid another financial crisis. Yesterday, the Securities and Exchange Commission approved a requirement that the sellers of investments in mortgages and credit card loans tell buyers just what's in those loans. The new rules take effect next January. From Washington, here's Marketplace's John Dimsdale.
Back in 2007, a lot of investors in mortgage-backed securities found out the hard way they'd been sold shaky loans. Securities dealers didn't tell them they were investing in subprime mortgages, and many of those homeowners couldn't make payments when housing prices fell. Ever since, the market for securities backed by mortgages or student loans or credit card debt has been struggling. To give future investors more confidence, the SEC says dealers have to tell buyers the mix of debts making up their investments. Portfolio manager Jack Sizelski says the bundlers of those securities should take heed.
They have a reason to be more careful about what they're putting together if they know there's going to be disclosures.
And if the quality of the loans doesn't improve?
If there's a lot of junk being pushed out and there's good disclosure about it, then the market's going to vote with their feet.
With better labeling, Sizelski says investors should pay more attention to what they're buying. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, January 21st. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You can follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York on Twitter, tweeting all the time at Jeremy Hobson, sometimes retweeting
what Steve tweets. Yes, you are.
Anyway.
I retweet some of what you tweet as well.
That's true. We're always retweeting back and forth. Now let's get to the global perspective, Steve.
And the global perspective, of course, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. European officials are investigating the disappearance of around 2 million so-called carbon credits. The theft has disrupted Europe's $120 billion a year market to trade pollution credits. From London, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
Cyber thieves hacked into some databases that serve Europe's carbon trading scheme. The largest such scheme in the world, it plays a key role in the EU's fight against climate change. Thousands of companies here can buy and sell permits which allow them to emit more CO2. Putting a price on carbon makes it profitable to cut emissions. But after this week's $40 million theft, the EU has halted all spot trading in the permits for at least a week. There is a suspicion that insiders may be behind the theft. Trevor Sikorsky is a carbon analyst with Barclays Capital. He says the five-year-old market is too loosely controlled.
We do need to tighten up access to the registries and make sure that everyone who's in this market is professionally regulated.
The market in carbon permits has already been plagued by fraud. The latest scam is a further blow to its credibility. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There are 15,000 polar bears in Canada, but unlike here in the U.S., there are no specific laws in Canada to protect polar bears. Well, now the Canadian government wants to make the polar bear a threatened species. And to do that, it wants to ask the question, how much is a polar bear worth? Here's the BBC's Lee Carter in Toronto.
Right now, polar bears in Canada are only valued in commercial terms, such as the value of their fur and their appeal to tourists. Mary Taylor is working with Canada's Environment Department to figure out how best to conserve the iconic predator. She says a broader value needs to be put on it.
The existence value, what's the value of having the species now and in the future? And we also look at sort of the bequest value, what's the value for future generations? So we're looking at a range of values and values even beyond those in the marketplace.
The method Taylor is describing is called total economic value. TEV is increasingly used in environmental economics. It takes into account the obvious and less apparent benefits of keeping a species around. A previous TEV study found the total value of an African elephant to be more than $4,000. Vic Adamovich is an environmental economist with the University of Alberta. He says this approach is necessary.
I think one of the challenges is, though, if we don't try to do these kinds of assessments, then often these species have implicitly a zero value placed on them. The value of improving these habitats or improving the quality of the species don't get measured in economic terms.
There is a debate, both inside and outside Canada, about whether the polar bear is endangered. There's no doubt that in recent years the Arctic ice the bears depend on has been melting, blamed by some environmentalists on climate change. Paul Ingout is the wildlife manager at Nunavut Tungavik, a land claims group. He says the study is a waste of time and the priority should be preserving the bears' shrinking habitat.
Why are they putting a value on polar bears? Is it because of climate change? If that's the case, then say it and take steps to deal with the climate change issue.
And while there may be disagreements about how accurate these studies are, governments are under increasing pressure to produce more of them, to find the value of animals and ecosystems under threat. In Toronto, Canada, I'm Lee Carter for Marketplace.
Patrick McCarthy created a new fragrance. It's called Liquid Money. Jeremy, have you heard of this?
No, I haven't.
He's got a fragrance for men. It's called His Money, and a fragrance for women, Her Money. How about that?
Perfect.
Guess what the scents smell like?
What?
Cold, hard cash. Like a newly minted $5 or $10 bill or $20 or Benji, whatever you want to call them. Now, he says that proves his fragrances will at the very least boost confidence. But he says he got the idea, McCarthy did, after reading about a study of Japanese companies that pumped the smell of money through its air conditioning vents where worker productivity jumped.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, January 21st. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Check out our website for the latest numbers, updated podcasts, and fun and exciting games such as the Future Jobs-O-Matic, which will choose the job you're suited for and how much money you'll make at it. That's all at our website, marketplace.org.
Now here's a story about two companies you've probably never heard of. Air Gas and Air Products and Chemicals. They provide specialty gases like oxygen, argon, and helium. And both companies are in a legal battle that may dramatically alter the way publicly traded companies change hands in the U.S. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Air Products is trying to take over Air Gas. Air Gas wants to stay independent. It's defending itself with something called a poison pill. The poison pill is this complex tactic that would increase the number of Airgas shares and make a takeover prohibitively expensive. Law professor Lynn Stout says without the poison pill, Airgas would have trouble fending off the hostile takeover.
The board of directors will lose control of the company to a new board that has interests that are very short-term in nature.
The poison pill has been around for nearly 30 years and was intended to protect shareholders. But Larry Harris of the University of Southern California says it protects top brass at a company, even if its performance isn't up to snuff.
So it's quite likely that if the poison pill were dropped, that we would see more efficient production in the United States, which is good for all of us.
A Delaware court is expected to rule on the case in the next few weeks. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
You no doubt have seen the barcode, right, Jeremy? You probably have something with a barcode on it right in front of you. I have a bottled water right here. There's a pencil with those markings on all kinds of products get scanned at the grocery store checkout, so it's very helpful. There's a new type of code that's popping up, a digital code that links the real world with the online world. And as reporter Alex Schmidt tells us, a lot of consumers still don't know what they are.
What they are is QR codes, which stands for quick response. They act kind of like barcodes for your smartphone. You scan these little boxes and a website comes up on your phone. From there, you can get things like coupons or digital downloads. And advertisers love them. QR designer Phil Warbass explains why.
What it really does is it turns a five-second pitch into potentially a five-minute experience, and it extends the time that you have to be in front of your audience.
Warbass has worked with Chipotle Restaurant to put QR codes in a menu, which takes users to a video with celebrities talking about healthy eating. And he's created one for Paula McMath. She's a singer who plays weekly on Santa Monica's 3rd Street Promenade. McMath has her QR codes printed on business cards. When you scan them, they take you to a website where you learn more about her music. But there's a potential problem. Passersby aren't quite sure what the barcodes are.
Have you ever seen these?
Never in my life.
I've never seen them before.
No. No.
McMath knows she's using an early stage technology.
I realize that on some level I am a little bit of a guinea pig, maybe?
But being experimental could also get her noticed. Lucy Hood directs USC's Institute for Communication Technology Management.
You think about it. You're a consumer, you're blobbing along, what's happening? What will make you pay attention? Something new.
Hood thinks QR codes will need a big, sustained media moment in the spotlight to really drive mass adoption, sort of like text messaging on American Idol. Hood convinced Idol producers to use that technology when she worked at Fox back in 2002.
We went from 12,000 text messages sent to 12 million in one season.
Hood's guess for QR's big moment of exposure? She thinks it'll happen with a movie sometime this year. I'm Alex Schmidt for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, here in New York, the Taxi and Limousine Commission has given the okay to a new dress code for cab drivers.
Oh, man. Oh, my gosh.
From now on, a professional appearance will be required.
Professional, well, yeah, of course.
Otherwise, they can be fined $25. So one annoyed driver who was at the meeting, I guess, where they talked about this, according to the New York Times, one annoyed driver told his buddy, "It's all about how we look to everyone else, never how they look to us." So be sure, if you're coming to New York, to make sure you dress for success if you get in a cab.
Dress up for that ride across to the Upper West Side. That's right.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, where cabbies can dress or undress however they like, I'm Steve Chiantakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.